scientific age, we need citizens who know enough about science to make intelligent decisions about what they do. We've used science to prolong life, to increase security and happiness. But it can also be used for destruction. Are we going to use it constructively? It'll be up to you, and you too.
So Todd,
yes.
This egg, bacon, and toast walk into a bar.
Okay.
And the bartender says, come on, guys, we don't serve breakfast here.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not prepared to pursue my line of inquiry any further, as I think this is getting too silly.
Quite agree. Guys. Silly. Right, get on with it. Get on with it.
All right, there's a little Monty Python.
Classic.
I was thinking we might have to retire. That classic bit that we do that makes no sense in front of at the beginning of every show, we might have to retire that at 100. I'm running out of, again, I am taking exceptions. I am taking ideas for clips to play after Mark's terrible jokes. So if we can beef up on my side the amount I have to play, that would be great. Because boy, am I running out of things to play. And you are not running out of dad jokes anytime soon.
We do 5 a week at work, and so I just pick from the best.
Right, you're tested and true.
What's also great is we just got a new a guy shifted from one other team to ours, and so he's just experiencing the jokes for the first time. And
oh man!
And so now he's the only one laughing, and everyone's like.
Stop encouraging him. We've all been there before. It leads to nowhere.
It's not good. And yeah, it doesn't go anywhere. I was going to try the, I was busy changing fuses over at BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
Number 7 shocked me. But I didn't do that.
But you didn't.
One.
You had too much self-control to do that one. That's all I had ready at the time. Sorry. All right. Well, welcome to another episode of the Mark and Todd Cast. I am one of your hosts, Todd Workhoven. And with me, as always, is Mark Middleton. How are you, Mark?
I'm well. I'm really well.
Good. It's like we just saw each other because we did just see each other yesterday when we were here with Brian Kidd, the Unipiper, doing episode number 2 of our other podcast, Portland at the Movies, and we watched The Hunted and talked all about it. I think we talked longer than the short running time of The Hunted, actually.
I think we talked longer than the producers and the script writers did to write the movie.
We offered more thought, than they did.
more attention to the plot than they ever thought to.
So I'll post that in a couple days here as soon as I get edited a little bit. And that should be going up on Friday, so do look out for it. But yes, what kind of news do we have today?
We got a bunch of things going on in and around the area, and also within the field of science. But just this last Thursday was Thanksgiving, and mm-hmm. on Thanksgiving,
where you made, I came to your house.
You
had an amazing turducken.
We did have a turducken.
Which is just a football of meat, wasn't that?
It wasn't. So we got a fresh turducken from our local Sheridan butcher.
A locally grown turducken.
A locally grown turducken. And it has cornbread stuffing, chorizo cornbread stuffing, inside the chicken,
right.
And then they take that chicken and put some sausage stuffing and put all of that inside a duck, and they take that duck and more stuffing and put it inside a turkey,
right.
And so it's a 14-pound wad.
Well, because I was going to say it's not like the carcasses, like you don't look inside.
It's all deboned.
Yeah,
so
it literally
all
is
meat. 14 pounds of
a completely dense
and so then,
rolled up wad of meat.
So
and
then
stuffing.
We coated. We took strips of bacon and put that on the outside and pinned it in there, and then it baked for like 6 hours.
Wow, it was really good. That was the first time I've ever had it,
and it turned out pretty well.
Anyway, so it was just Thanksgiving.
And
which is leading us into a story.
My buddy Todd Thalamer is watching from Colorado. We got a whole bunch of people.
I feel like this is the
my neighbor across the street, Jackie.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember Romper Room? Do you remember Romper Room? The old show that I maybe it used to be a Southern California
romper,
thing.
Romper Stomper Bumper Boo. Tell me.
But
tell
I remember
me,
they would hold up the
magic
mirror.
I
see Mark and I see Nick.
Every
and
week,
I
would hope that she would
say
call out
name.
My name, but she never did.
Did you ever send in your name, or you just hope? Oh, she didn't
no,
use
she
last
didn't.
Name. She would just use just generic. Oh, okay, I see.
And I see Stacy and. And I see
she doesn't see me, Mom.
That's mirror she isn't that magic.
She never sees me.
We Kathleen Burney and Greg Cochran. Greg Cochran, my old business partner, is here. Like we got
wow.
the
we should conduct some
everybody.
Business while we're here and get something actually accomplished.
Seriously.
Solve the world's problems.
Post my resume up there.
more people use this than LinkedIn, apparently. did I tell you I got made? Well. I got made fun of at your Halloween party for not being on LinkedIn or for not knowing if I was on LinkedIn and thinking LinkedIn was something that nobody used, and then they made fun of me.
No, LinkedIn is used solely for finding a job.
I think it's just solely so that you can tell people you have a link. Like, I don't think right. anyone uses it. Like, do people who are hiring for jobs use LinkedIn, or just people looking for jobs?
They're spamming everybody.
Right.
Like, it's mostly... I don't know.
I think it's like, just, it's kind of like a business card. Like you
right,
have to have it
right.
just to, so I didn't think anyone actually
I read
used it
LinkedIn
hiring.
Profiles of people who apply for positions at my company.
But only be if they have them, right? Not, like that's not your entry point or anything,
no.
but you, when you Google their name and that comes up, you read it. Right, so
exactly.
it can only be used to like
so,
do bad things for your career.
So this last Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Hello.
This last Thanksgiving, So recently, the FBI has officially closed the D.B. Cooper case.
Okay, yep.
And the official confidential documents have been released.
Oh.
And so you can go to a website.
Right in time to make our podcast about 4 weeks ago completely not up to date at all.
Totally.
So thank you, FBI.
So the D.B. Cooper Project, you can go put in your email address and you can sign up. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands of documents. And many of them have not been... looked at in many years, and the guy who's curating all of this
yeah.
is like, honestly, I haven't looked through all of these myself, but here you go. And
wow.
and so he's made those public. And
so I guess we'll find out in a couple of days here if there's any shocking
D.B. Cooper
number 7 might yep. shock us.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then you had some information about a hospital and
I do. There's a hospital will open its very first dedicated 3D bioprinting facility. This is in Australia. An Australian hospital is becoming the first to receive the dedicated 3D printing tissue facility. I think you typed this out for me, didn't you?
I did.
The new facility at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane will open in 2017, where doctors and technicians will collect samples of the patient's cells and use them to grow entirely new body parts. This technology could drastically reduce the need for tissue donors and also improve research. Eventually, the hospital envisions a tissue printing machine right next to every operating table. God, it's so weird.
The implications of this are... astounding,
right?
As so, like blood marrow transfusions or
bone marrow
bone marrow transplants, kidney transplants, and things that have a really high propensity for rejection by your body,
right?
And so they are taking cells from that person and putting it into a computer and building more of those cells. And
what a time to be alive?
Yes.
Question mark?
Yes. the answer is yes.
Yes? Question mark?
Question mark. we can rebuild him better, stronger, faster.
Yeah.
And you know, this is beyond the. I hear
you did get my message.
Unipiper did receive the message.
Yay! Hello, Unipiper Brian. How are you?
Hello, Brian.
Hello? Hey, Todd.
Oh. It sounded like the ocean there for a second. I was confused. Can you hear? Can you hear us? Okay.
Am I on dry land now?
Oh, there we are. There we are.
Okay.
What's up in your world? What's going on in Portland this week?
Oh man, I was just looking for a fun Portland fact to share, and I just read something on the internet that I'd never heard before, and I was excited to impart the knowledge that the Mai Tai was invented in Portland.
What?
But then I did my homework and I found that it wasn't true.
Oh.
Well, that was pretty shocking for a couple seconds there.
I know.
So, it was a roller coaster ride.
Don't believe everything you read. Instead, I have one quick news item that I feel merits mention. The Paris Theater is no longer a porn theater.
Well,
as the marquee proudly proclaims.
I found that out last night when... Wait. No, I'm just kidding. So what is it now?
It looks like it's going to be another nightclub slash music venue slash all-purpose space.
I forget where that is.
Now, that's the one right next to Voodoo Donuts.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Which makes it interesting because, you know, there's always kind of been that seedy underbelly of that area. And
right.
Very funny juxtaposition of all the tourists and people from the suburbs waiting in line at Voodoo Donuts standing literally in front of the porn theater.
Yes, and there seems to be always a heroin junkie that is like passing needles and everything like between tourists, and it's
the Southeast Portland welcome kit.
It is that
Voodoo
Donuts
and heroin.
Yep. And there's all the children there with the families that are asking questions about what is going on in the fun building that's painted purple, but. So we're going to lose a little bit of that charm, if you will, but I'm happy to see that that area is we're actually doing something
right.
with that area.
Right. So did I already forget what you said? But it's going to be plans to be a what now?
A music venue.
Oh, music venue. That's right.
Yeah. And according to the sign, I think it's already open and stuff. So
do you think? Oh, so it's not. Do you think it's going to cater to kind of the new Southeast, or is it going to try to be, you know, the kind of the grimier Southeast that we kind of know and love, or is it going to be kind of the gentrified type of locations that all of Southeast is turning into, do you think?
I don't know. I think it looks like it's going to preserve some of the grime.
Nice.
Like if it wasn't for the sign that said it's no longer a porn theater, you may not realize that.
People just kept walking in and being shocked at the lack of pornography available there. Nice. Well, anything else of note happening this week or that you have going on?
Yeah, I wanted to, I thought it would be interesting to go back and talk a little bit about the origin of the phrase "keep Portland weird."
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, we hear about it a lot, and it's got a little bit of an interesting story behind it, and, you know, it's a little bit more meaningful if you know where it comes from.
Perfect. So what do you got?
So, you know, the first thing you hear usually when you start talking about that is, oh, we stole that from Austin.
Right, exactly.
Or you stole that from Austin or whatever. And it's kind of true. I like to say that we borrowed it from Austin. You know, stealing implies that we took it and they no longer have it.
Right.
Which is not true. They still say keep Austin weird.
Right.
But so Terry Clark, who is a giant in the Oregon music scene. He was inducted into the Oregon Music Hall of Fame. He is the current owner of Music Millennium.
Right.
It was his brainchild to bring this slogan to Portland back in the late 90s. That was kind of the boom of all of the big box stores and things like Barnes & Nobles and Tower Records popping up. And that was actually the genesis of the phrase in Austin, was to just try and encourage people to shop locally.
Right.
So he borrowed it for that explicit purpose and started saying keep Portland weird. And the very first bumper stickers that he had printed, he had some printed that said keep Portland weird, and then the other half of the stickers said keep Portland weird, support local business.
Interesting.
And I guess you see which one catching on.
Yeah, I have to look out for that now.
But that doesn't mean that you know, the idea is still behind it. But you know, now that it's sort of taken on a life of its own outside of its original meaning, Terry was recently interviewed about the meaning of Keep Portland Weird, and I think it's pretty cool that he said that one of the great things about it is that it is open to interpretation for what it means. And his quote, when asked what it means to him, was that it's all about keeping Portland unique and staying away from turning Portland into strip malls with national chains that are in every other city, USA.
Right. So basically what's happening to Portland now.
Yes. So.
And it used to be painted on a different building, right? Because I remember when we worked at our agency, Mark, I felt like it was on the park, not on the park blocks, but on Broadway, kind of by, not on the other side of Burnside, but still on the north side of Burnside. It was on that, across from Embers or whatever that place is. There's that right. building, that old building that always right. has the, and I felt like it was there. And then I looked for it one day and it moved behind Dante's, but maybe it's always been at Dante's.
I don't know the history of the location.
Huh. But yeah, so now it's painted on the backside
of Dante's,
right? Yeah.
And then also on the side of the Music Millennium building on Burnside.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it's really cool. You know, he does, Terry owns the trademark to the phrase Keep Portland Weird. He sold it to Dante's for $1 to put on the side of the building.
Oh, nice.
Oh, that's pretty great.
He does a lot of things like that for city use and for schools and you know, for good causes.
Yeah. He's always been very active in the music scene in Portland, and he's at most concerts that you go to. And did you know that current Music Millennium building on Burnside, that used to be a Piggly Wiggly?
Yeah.
Really?
A grocery store back up until the 60s, I believe.
Huh.
Yeah. Oh, Piggly Wiggly.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. I will end by saying that to put any argument to rest, in 2014, there was an investigation by an unnamed Austin business looking into which city was weirder, Portland or Austin. And they concluded that out of 14 categories, Portland was weirder in 9 of them. So Portland was, in fact, the weirder city.
Nice.
That was 2 years ago. So a lot it has changed in Portland in just the past 2 years.
Right.
So keep Portland weird now more than ever.
All right.
Indeed.
And we can find out more about you at theunipiper.com.
That's where you can find me.
All right. We'll talk to you later, Brian.
Okay. Good speaking to you.
Bye. Ciao.
Keep Portland weird.
Yeah, indeed.
All right. Where were we? I think we were going to Plymouth Rock.
So we did have a question from Greg Cochran, my old business partner, about which city in Australia was the 3D printing, and I responded with Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane.
Brisbane,
Australia.
I thought it was going to be some sort of knock on my lack of accent or completely mispronouncing.
Nope.
No, it's not Brisbane. It's Brisbane.
Brisbane.
Everybody knows it's Brisbane.
Yeah. So it turns out that they believe that they've found conclusive evidence of the original 1620 Plymouth settlement in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And so they've discovered the calf's, a baby cow. Remains in one of their digs, along with old musket balls and 17th century pottery and a bunch of artifacts that line up with
that time period
in that area. And what caught me most in watching and looking at this article is the photo of the archaeological dig is happening basically in somebody's front yard because it's in a residential area of Plymouth. And so you can see a white picket fence on the other side of the street.
I flagged the story. I don't know that.
At another house, but it is literally like, it could be our front yard.
It is in their yard, not like adjacent to.
They're digging the grass.
There's a big skeleton they're uncovering there.
Totally.
Wow, that's hilarious.
It's just right next to the sidewalk.
I'll have to post that picture.
And you're looking at the foundation of
this
European settlement in this country.
Some guy's yard. Wow, that's trippy. Because, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's not that far down. I mean, it's what, three
or four feet
down? Wow, that looks so fake. It looks like an Onion article for like a child's digging experiment gone wrong.
So I tested this out before the show as well. Google has updated their profiles for their business profiles. I've noticed recently that you can see the trend of activity at a business. So if you're going to the Screen Door restaurant in Portland, you can see what times to go for a given day, when it's really busy and when it's not really busy, based on people's, check-ins, and they're reading the social media activity and people's phones and all of that. And now you can see in real time. And so you can say, hey, let's go to the Screen Door, and you pull it up on Google and it'll say, it's not really busy right now, okay, or it is like, busy, like, or it's
45 minute wait.
Right. It doesn't do the the detail of checking in with the
app is useless,
but it does give you a general indication of busyness at the current moment, which is
but that counts on people checking in and posting from there, or is that that's not how it figures out how many people are there?
I think they
just
probably
call
go
every restaurant every 15 minutes. How busy are you now?
They probably just have a connection into the NSA database. They definitely know, but. There's a lot of empirical data that people get from phones,
right?
And a lot of companies. There's a annual conference on search optimization for data for websites and everything. And
wild party, by the way.
Wild party,
crazy those people.
The average Starbucks has 16 sensors throughout the roof that track. So when you approach, your phone is broadcasting a unique ID, the ID of your phone, because it's looking for wireless connections.
Right.
And so they use that to see, okay, well, first he walked right in and got into the queue line, and then he was distracted by the silver thing on this and looked at that for a minute, walked around, checked out the CD that they had available, and then got back into the queue line. And they are tracking every single individual that go with 16 sensors, and it's like 200 square feet.
That is crazy.
It is absolutely,
but I know they do that for like department stores too.
Department stores, same deal.
And that way they lay it out in the best way that you'll pass everything.
Yeah, the queuing is a data driven slaughterhouse.
So you would have to you'd have to turn off your phone.
Go into airport mode.
Okay.
All times.
All right.
Always
put Band-Aid over the camera that comes out of your screen,
and so that kind of data, if you used Google Maps to get to there, it has location services turned on and knows exactly where you are.
Right,
and so then you got out of the thing, and your location services are still on. If you've got an Android device with your location services on, and your Apple account, or you are using Gmail, or you received a text message, or any of these things that have location services. And many of those location services, when you authorize them, authorize for all time, not just while you're using the app. And so
that is literally the first thing I did, was turned off my location services, and except for three of them where it's like only when that thing is open.
And so if any of those Apple apps have authorization for your location services, they know exactly where you are at all times.
Right.
And so
still the irony that when you dial 911 on them, they cannot find you.
Right. You're in Portland somewhere. So that's a thing, and they're doing it. Archaeology. So mammoth discovery could revise human timetables. So they discovered a big trove of mammoth bones in
North Dakota or something?
Yeah. Write down
one of those northern countries.
Yeah. In Michigan, in a farmer's lake, basically in his backyard again, in Michigan. And what's interesting about this one is, so it places humans in the Americas 15,000 years ago.
Okay.
And there's evidence to show that humans took down these mammoths and then harvested them. So they took chunks of meat and then removed the bones and then like organized the bones into okay. different areas. And there's also evidence...
Because they were OCD.
and they rebuilt it over here in just bones. They used a meat locker storage. There's a hypothesis of a meat locker storage process that, okay. that they did. Because if you harvested the meat off of this woolly mammoth, what are you going to do with it? And so what this archaeologist hypothesizes, and there's physical evidence to support this, they have big round rocks that aren't typical for that part of the river. They're very out of place.
Right.
And they take reeds of plants and tie meat to it and submerge it underwater.
Okay.
And keep it underwater. So it keeps it away from other animals.
Predators.
And spoilage and everything. And then they bring lift one of them up and then go and cook that meat.
Okay.
So there's an archaeologist who has reproduced that process.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't die, which was the summation
that was
of the article.
The is one like, goal is to not die. Success.
So he was able to make a meat locker out of the most rudimentary pieces of you know, a rock.
I would still think it would spoil underwater.
Ultimately, it will, but the amount of time that it was able to keep was like tenfold.
Right.
And even if the meat goes bad a little bit, you can still cook out the bad.
Right.
And
it doesn't go rancid.
It doesn't go rancid. Yeah, it's not going to kill you.
Right.
If you
interesting.
Know, and so. So they have evidence in this archaeology dig that supports all of those claims.
So is 15,000 years
significantly further back?
So what was until now? What did we think?
So there's a place in New Mexico called Clovis, New Mexico, uh-huh. that our friend Pam lives in,
okay.
And there's a Clovis colony, and basically what they found is an arrowhead that they dated back to the Clovis colony. And up until these mammoth bone hypothesis,
right.
the Clovis colony was the supposed earliest settler, you know, earliest humans into the Americas. And I know you are going to be asking
when that was. I'm distracted right now, but I'll buy you some time. I've been saying that the Clovis colony sounds like a clown college. The Clovis colony.
So the Clovis colony, Clovis High School, Mystery of the First Americans, close.
Ooh, that sounds good.
11,000 years ago. And okay. so this raised the number by 4,000 years.
Wow.
And so imagine.
That's a long time.
You know, from here to the Egyptian.
Times.
Yeah, times.
Boy, yeah. That's so crazy.
It's insane. So.
Huh.
So.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before, just chatting off the air, but doing that thing now that we're older of like the time between the Bee Gees and Michael Jackson is
yes.
now the, you know, whatever, and to all those pop culture things now that we're old, and just that puts it in the context too, when you just like enough time between, and I've seen that before, there is more time between like Babylon and now as there was between, you know, whatever, which is just so such a trippy way to look at time.
I always like, when I was born in 1971, I'm 45 years old. So a 45-year-old in 1971 was born in 1926. And think about all of the things that somebody between 1926 and 1971 experienced.
Yeah.
You know, the space race, you know, World War II,
right.
You know, so many things, the 20s that, you know, the so many crazy things.
The roaring 20s, the something 30s, the big time 40s, the super deluxe 50s.
Yeah.
Did any other decade have, now that I'm thinking about it, I mean, we have the roaring 20s. Was there anything else?
The
go-go 60s? No.
There
that's
was
kind of interesting.
I thought it was the gay. There was the
gay. Well, that's gay, the gay. That's the 20s also.
Right.
It was gay and roaring.
Of course it was.
Which is why we never speak of it.
Right. Not a mixed company.
Not at Thanksgiving dinner, at least. Totally. Just wait until we're all done, all right? We can talk about it later.
Oh, you were there at Thanksgiving. And give us a molasses update.
Oh, yeah. So one of the stories I saw going around on Facebook this week, a couple weeks ago or something like that, at the end of the show, I just kind of offhandedly mentioned the big tsunami of molasses that happened in Boston in 1919. And we kind of gave the broad strokes, but up until now, people haven't been, I mean, people I've obviously known this story, but have been trying to figure out why it was so devastating on account of molasses isn't that fast. It wasn't the people that died in the initial explosion, which was pretty dramatic, but it was people that like were literally stuck in it. So these college students, they figured out it's a difference in temperature between the Boston Harbor and where they were getting the molasses in the Caribbean. So the Caribbean is a lot warmer than Boston. So the molasses is a lot runnier and a lot less viscous than when it's cold. And so when it was in, they're hypothesizing that when it was in the tank, it was still a couple degrees cooler than the outside air. So that when it did explode, it did have, like before it came, kind of a thick lava-y thing going on. There was an initial, like very liquid expulsion of that, and people would get they have this horrible which I'm going to read on the show. The historical record says the initial wave of molasses moves at about 35 miles an hour. At the time, people thought there must have been an explosion in the tank, but after teams ran the experiments, it discovered that the molasses could indeed move at that speed. It's an interesting result. But then they had a firefighter who survived the initial wave managed to stay alive for nearly 2 hours while he waited to be rescued, he said, but he drowned. And his quote was, men and women, their feet trapped by the sticky mass, slipped and fell and were suffocated, said the Boston Globe in 1968. The stronger tried to save the others, and many of them died for their heroism. So they still don't know why the tank failed, but they're saying that
it's a big fly trap.
Yeah.
A big gooey fly trap.
Yeah, totally. Like in Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Warriors, where the one girl goes into the Roach Motel thing, and then she gets all stuck and her arms come out and
never
she turns into an insect.
Never saw that.
Or maybe three but is The Dream Warriors. No, I can't remember.
We do have questions from the audience, though.
Oh, we do?
Yeah. So
we never have questions from the audience at home.
We never do. Heather, our beautiful neighbor, Heather, says,
keep it down. We can hear you. We are tired of having this conversation.
Such sophistication. Tyler, a good friend and coworker, he says, Mark, do you think that technology will advance as quickly in the next 45 years as it has in the last 45 years?
Ah.
And unequivocally, absolutely, I think it'll be a magnitude faster.
Right.
Yeah, is the rate of change of information and how information is being spread, it was always the limiting factor in technology development.
Mm-hmm.
That barrier is just going away.
Do you think there's been as dramatic a change in the making of materials as there has in like quote unquote technology, like a computer type technology, like with the things we think of when we always think of technology, it's always kind of computer based. But I mean, a lot of these things that we're seeing are difference in materials.
Yeah. And materials and the
that carbon nano stuff terrifies me.
Or
the aerogel. Have you seen the aerogel thing?
I love aerogel.
Some aerogel
I used to have
for your birthday.
I used to have a little piece of aerogel.
Then it blew away. And it could not grow.
Aerogel is the lightest substance made, and so I bought I spent $40 for a little 1-inch cube or something. It was like 10 years ago, and it's light. We're super light. It lives up to its claim. So I believe that absolutely technology will. For materials, I think of the production of silicon wafers. And just so I worked in the silicon industry when I first got out of the Navy in the 90s, and the standard was a 6-inch wafer with a chip density that was really good. And the rate of increase of both the size of the wafer and the chip density has just gone up exponentially. And so they're doing 18-inch wafers, and the density of processors that are on that are just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you need a electron microscope to be able to even get any.
That's what we'll need to talk about that one of these days, because I don't understand electron microscopes work at all.
Nice.
Anyway.
Yeah, I would love to mark that
put
down.
It on our list.
And do we have any other?
I do. I have one more, which was adorable. I put this story on the list, and I didn't tell you what it was going to be, so I can surprise you. And I just put a Catholic Church app. And you went in and dutifully went to the Catholic Church and saw what their app had to offer, thinking that was my story. That is not my story. This story is about a different Catholic Church app, Cinder, for those with an urgent confession. Confession, they say, is good for the soul, and in some cases, the sooner the better. Now, for those with a burning need to unburden themselves, one Roman Catholic archdiocese has launched what he thought is to be the world's first interactive GPS-powered, confession finder. Using similar technologies to the dating hookup app Tinder, I thought Tinder didn't have ER at the end. I thought it was just R, isn't it? T-I-N-D-R?
That's Grindr.
Oh.
That's that other app.
I barely knew her.
Using similar technologies, it guides the penitent from their current location within the Archdiocese of St. Andrew and blah, 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 and over to Mass. Developed by the Archdiocese, the new service available on iPhone and tablet is officially named the Catholic app, but looks certain to be named Cinder, blah, blah, blah. So this little bit of smart technology could make a big impact on how the Catholic Church brings the mercy of God and the joy of the gospel to our contemporary world, said the Archbishop. So I thought that was pretty funny. The Cinder app from the Catholic Church.
I love it.
All right. Is that all we had for news and notes today?
It is.
All right. Well, I kind of wanted to talk about a couple of things that, as it seems like everybody is trying to do a post analysis of what happened this election? What is going on? Why are people so divided? All this stuff, this.
Because of the millions of illegal voters.
Yes.
Sorry. That breaking
news. Well, we don't know all of the facts yet, but our sources, and these horses are high. It's hard to get a higher source than the one we heard this from. But there have been millions, at least three at this count from this source, 3 million illegal voters that voted in this election, which invalidates it or strengthens it. We're still asking that higher source. But he only speaks in 140 characters or less, so it's hard to get a lot of information out of him. But anyway, so something that interests me is watching people be surprised at what quote unquote the other side is doing when there is, I think, not a lot of interplay in between groups and in between people who are thinking different ideas. And there's a couple different cognitive biases that fall into this. And I want to take a look at two of them. And one of them is called the confirmation bias. And the overview of this is that your opinions are a result of years of paying attention to all the information while being ignorant of the things that you used to believe, ignoring the information that challenged your previous notions. So you hear, it's kind of like when I got my car, I drive a little Chevy Cruze. And when I started driving that, boy, I started noticing how many people had Chevy Cruzes, and boy, they must be, there must have been an uptick in sale or whatever. Well, no, I have just now begun noticing that. Or like when you're going to graduate or when you're getting married or having a baby, you kind of suddenly notice all the products or all the people or all the ways things happen just for the people that are happening just like you. And you disregard the 100 million impulses and information inputs that didn't have anything to do with, I forget what it was last week. It wasn't Gilligan's Island, but it was some like, it was some ridiculous episode of something or other that I randomly thought of in the car and then noticed like five more times that day it came up. And it was one of those like
Small Wonder.
Yeah, it was probably Small Wonder because I'm always thinking about Small Wonder. Thinking about Small Wonder the other day and wondering, are we going to be, I'm going on a Small Wonder tangent. We don't have a sound effect for that.
We should.
We totally, I'm going to write that down. Small Wonder tangent. Soundbite. If it's going to be easier for people to accept robots and AI in their houses, if say it looked more like a toaster type device than it looks like a humanoid Vicky the Robot type thing, is it going to be easy for us to invite something that looks more like a machine into our lives with that kind of stuff? Or is it going to be easier for them to be humanoid, or is it going to be harder if it's a like all of those things? So I was thinking of Vicky the Robot versus a toaster the other day. Anyway, so confirmation bias is when the things you already believe, you already have those little sticky notes in your head of the things you already believe. And so when you get that rush, that wind, that blizzard of information, more things stick to those areas because you already have a place in your brain for those things. So those areas stick and everything either gets disregarded or completely, you're completely unaware, like the car thing, how you weren't aware that you were unaware of that thing until you're like that great Donald Rumsfeld quote, the unknown, there are known knowns, unknown knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns, which is, man, that is beautiful. So a huge example of this, and this is the one that everybody uses, is just
Rumsfeld doing today?
I don't know. Stealing babies' breaths so that he can live more stronger and powerful. He's just
drunk in the corner.
Angrily muttering at himself. Where did I go wrong? But speaking of Rumsfeld, you see this like 100% of the time when you're almost any sort of news source that we're getting now has turned from journalism into that punditry because of that confirmation bias. So anyone that's talking about the news, like Rush, do people still listen to Rush Limbaugh? I know he's still on the, I mean, he used to be like the force in conservative punditry. Right. And then there's, you know, I don't know who has the left of that job. Everybody always says poor Alan Combs, because he's the only example we have of, I mean, everybody is coming from, and especially in the media, they are serving up the confirmation bias that its viewers already have. And the tricky thing through that is organizations and marketers and advertisers are very good at removing the thing that they make us individuals feel like we're the only ones who have it figured out. And we have found this source of news, this source of information that if it's not, if it's our filter, we love them. If it's not, we hate them, and we don't watch the things that,
which I'm sure aids in your motivation to share it with others. I just found out that Elon Musk has been stealing from the American taxpayers by blowing up Falcon 9 rockets. I need to get that information out.
Right.
And that was a fake news article that came out last week.
Nice.
Right.
So half a century of research has praised the confirmation bias, which is either just specifically seeking out or for some reason only paying attention to the things that you are already believing, as one of the most dependable of mental stumbling blocks, which is why scientists and specifically scientists and supposedly journalists are taught to really look out for that. Because if you're like the true journalist, then you keep your confirmation bias out of it. You say A happened and that's it. But that's, I think, what has changed. And I think what people complain about the most I would say, outside, not necessarily of the actual talking head pundits, but the other thing I hear is like, well, it's not so much what they say, it's the news stories that they choose to talk about or to focus on, or and we rally to the ones, because it plays into the kind of the next bias of figuring out conformity, because we are primates essentially, and we seek allies and we seek conformity, because conformity is the way to teamwork and to building and for shared customs and language and knowledge and
safe and
and so it is a legitimate,
that makes sense,
a legitimate purpose. And so it's interesting to look at all these things that are built inside of us, that like I can't do anything about the need to conform. Like, I can be aware of it, but I'm not gonna go live in a tent, you know, somewhere else and abandon electricity and just to be different. And so conformity isn't just, and I always think about this when I go, when you talk about going to other countries, going to a culture that's mine makes me really, really anxious, because I don't know all of those little customs and all of the, this gesture means this, especially you lived in Italy. I mean, weren't you terrified? Because everything, like gesturing is
all
their
they
language,
do.
Right.
There's so many Italian gestures.
Right.
They teach their kids from infants when they can't speak, when the infant can't speak, sign language. That is just common Italian verbiage.
Right.
And so like, I'm hungry is just a chopping to the stomach area, and it's good, it's delicious.
So do adults,
I want more
still
spaghetti.
Do that?
Yes.
Like when they talk, so they'll tap at their side
more,
a little bit.
I
when
want
they
more
want
spaghetti.
More.
And,
hey,
yeah,
I want the most spaghetti.
And so it's two fingers, and it's not more pasta. I want more spaghetti. Is two fingers. I had, we lived on the second floor of an apartment building, and there was a package being delivered to the fourth floor, but she wasn't there. And the postman rung our buzzer, and he left the package with me to deliver to her. And he didn't speak a word of English, and my Italian was very rusty.
Right.
And we got over the basics of this package is for her and
right.
stuff. And he looked at me, and he pulled down his lower eye and looked deeply into me, and I didn't know exactly what the implement. Yeah,
right.
I didn't know what, and it's literally the Italian for "I'm watching you."
Okay,
I know,
pointing at your own eyes and then pointing back at the others with the two fingers.
Right,
oh, interesting.
I'm watching you, and I, you know, if it doesn't make it to her, you will hear from me again.
Right,
and
that's pretty great.
And of course, I put it at the wrong door, and it took 2 days. But he never came back. But she came to our door, and we got it all solved.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious!
Thank God it was still there.
So conformity in those things is, like I said, is like a hugely important survival instinct and something that's just built into us. But it's all of these psychological things that I kind of like learning about, because it exposes at least the way I'm thinking of things. And like I said, everybody thinks I'm the one that's got it figured out. And then you right. read something and you're like, I am completely the same as every other human being that's ever gone before me. But I think knowing that helps, because, you know, like you said, you know to look for your confirmation bias. So in 1951, psychologist Solomon Ash put together an experiment, and he had a group of about 10 people at a conference room table, and they all had different glasses of water, and he would go around. All of them were equal, except not all of them were equal, but one of them clearly had more water in it than any of the other ones, and he would ask the table, come to a consensus. And so 98% of the people got the answer right when they were tested. When they went around the table, blah, 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 everyone's like, well, clearly that one has more liquid in it. What the psychologist started doing was replacing the 10 people with actors that were in on the experiment. And those actors were told to give the wrong answer to see at what point the subject, the real subject,
changes,
would start questioning, like, maybe I'm seeing things wrong, maybe what's going on. So with that coercion, so he noticed that if there was maybe two or three people, or one to two people kind of dissenting, that never got a whole lot of traction. But when you got to three, incrementally, as you go up, three, four, five, proportionally and exponentially, the
rate of change,
would go up to 75%. Getting at least, they had like five or so questions, getting at least one of those wrongs. And not only did the subjects do that without being pressured, like this wasn't a 12 angry men, like they're all hammering it out, whatever, like without coercion, they would just say, well, I guess. And then they wouldn't remember, like after the experiment, like, you remember that one that was clearly more full? They would not remember. They would make excuses for why that could have happened. Like normal, intelligent, capable people would go along with a group and then A, be confused they were going along with a group, but also be confused as to why they were doing it. I mean, a lot of these things, like we said, like when you're deciding a restaurant or deciding like a group movie to go to, like that's where could, and another example is like at the movie theater when everyone's waiting in a line that you just start standing in because you don't ask anyone what the line is for. And then you realize like that kind of stuff. Okay. But when it starts getting.
And I want to think that I wouldn't be susceptible to that, but then I know that I am the prime marketing objective. Like I know that my brain is fashioned to respond to what marketers are doing.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is that me personally, and I think everybody, it's easy to see the advertising that's marketed at someone else and not for you. Like it's easy to spot things outside of your demographic or outside of your interest and be like, that's clearly like who falls for that kind of advertising, but we're just completely blind to everything that works on us like that.
We've had such a collection of people coming in. So Eric Dodd just joined, and I think he just dropped off, so we won't hear this.
We can badmouth him now.
No, he was a coworker of mine in the Navy in the 90s on that submarine.
Nice.
And now he's gone. But Melissa Workla and Kent is with us.
Hello, watchers and listeners.
Yay.
So there's a quote from a psychologist named Noam Spencer, Spancer, which cracked me up today. There's no C in there. It's just Spencer. Says, quote, exactly. We are often not even aware of when we are conforming. It is our home base, our default mode. He says you conform because your social acceptance is built into your brain. To thrive, you need to know, you need allies. You need to get a better picture of the world. You need friends. And when you're surrounded by others, you look for cues on how to behave. When everyone you know decides the answer for an awesome app or on the phone book or on the phone or a book you should read, you always listen to them because they're your friends and that's who you're used to. You trust enough to conform to. But I also wanted to talk about probably the most famous experiment when it comes to conformity, and that is the experiments of Stanley Milgram, who not only did the Stanford Prison experiment, which is just messed up. So just so I don't want to get my facts wrong, I'm going to read a little summary of the other experiment that he did, which was performed by Stanley Milgram in 1963. He had people sit in a room and take commands from a scientist in a lab coat. He told them they would be teaching word pairs to another subject in the next room, and each time their partner got an answer wrong, they were to give them an electric shock. A control panel on a complicated-looking contraption clearly indicated the power of the shock. Switches along a single row were labeled with increasing voltages and a description. At the low end, it read slight shock. In the middle, it was labeled intense shock. And at the end of the scale, the switch read XXX, which implied death. The man sat in a lab coat and would prompt the subject pressing the buttons to shock the partner in the next room. With each shock, screams emanated from the next door. After the screams, the scientist in the lab coat asked the subject to increase the voltage. The screams would get louder, and eventually the subjects could hear the guy in the other room pleading for his life and asking the psychologist to end the experiment. Most subjects asked if they could stop. They didn't want to shock the poor man in the next room, but scientists would urge them to continue. telling them not to worry. So they would start with things with just like, if they would say, do I have to continue this? They would just simply say yes. And if they pressed, they would go up to things like, it is important to the experiment. It is important to our data. You have no other choice. You must go on. The experiment requires. To everyone's surprise, 65% of people could be prompted to go all the way right below triple X. In reality, of course, there was no shocks and everyone was in except the thing. And it's been repeated. The percentage of people who go all the way can be dropped to zero by removing the authority figure. It could be raised into the 90% range by having someone else give the test while the subject only has to deliver the shock. So if you were asking the questions and I had to give the shocks, just that disconnect, even though I am still giving the shocks,
and it's because of me asking the question.
Right. It is no longer in my hands. 90%.
I would totally do it. I know I would.
Fry the bastards. I mean, that is just...
It's terrible.
It is terrible.
And, you know, his experiments, the Stanford prison experiment is grueling. There's tons of footage because it was a research project.
Yeah.
They have tons and tons of footage. And so there's been a recreation of that. There's a movie made.
I heard about the movie. I didn't see it.
The movie is exactly frame for frame for the experiment.
Oh.
And so there's no other, there's a little bit of the backstory.
Right.
And kind of their families and stuff, but just a little. It is precisely a recreation of the Stanford prison experiment.
Jeez.
And it's terrible to watch us as humans devolve based on manipulation from marketing.
And not just that we devolve, but the speed at which humans devolve into that primitive. I mean, you take away our electricity for a couple days and humanity will
completely devolve.
I mean, we feel like we're on this like really safe mental island, you know, away from the rest of barbarism and animalism and all that stuff. But we are just tethered right to that.
When Nick fails to pay the water bill and we get that letter of like, you have 3 days. I'm like, you know that we're 3 days from
dying,
from being cavemen. Like, because...
Well, that's the end of the process. Like, in the next 3 days, you are becoming the caveman.
I just know that we are so suckling the teat of modern conveniences in this world that we are privileged to live in.
I was having a discussion about the differences between George Orwell's 1984 and the book Brave New World, Alice Huxley's Brave New World, and George Orwell is very famous, you know, the authoritarian big brother is always watching all of this thing to control you like prisoners. Mm. Brave New World is about people more or less overdosing on their own luxury. They've got pills, the soma pills to make themselves, they're entertained, they've got TV, they've got all this thing. There's no need to control them because they are controlling themselves through their own pleasure, which to me is a lot more apt to. But the fact that 65% of us and up to 90% will literally go to the brink of murder because some guy in a lab coat is saying,
it's important for this research.
I remember, I think I've told this story on the show before, but I heard the story about during one of the war trial, the Nazi war trials they had. Some Nazi prison guard was on trial, and they had some of the people that were in his concentration camp in the gallery, you know, watching the trial. And the Nazi prisoner guard went on the stand, and you know, some people were identifying them, and one of the men in the audience in the gallery just started, you know, weeping, and it was the first time that he had seen this guard, and so everyone, he was just overcome, and people asked, you know, why. Was it because you're seeing evil and because you're seeing this darkness? And he's like, no, I see me. I see every single one of us in this person that did that. And that is the scariest thing in the world, is that we are all that Nazi prison guard. So it's, I wrote down the problems we have don't come because we are mindless, predictable, non-original, and just like everyone else. The problem, I think, becomes when we refuse to admit that we are, so that we don't know what we're supposed to be looking out for. And there's one more little thing that works into it, is called the third person bias. The third person bias is basically when we say things like those people, or on the other side, like especially during talks of censorship, it's won't someone think of the children? Won't someone think of this group? Like, not, it's not affecting the people who are saying the thing. It's affecting this mysterious third party that doesn't have like any reality or any three dimensions to it. And I see that lots happening too, because we don't know what the other, quote unquote, the other side thinks, that we're all kind of standing, around this big number on the floor, and situated like you and I are, and we're having this big argument on what number that is on the floor, because it's so clearly obvious to anyone standing where I'm standing what that number is. And it's so clearly obvious to everyone on your side that everyone knows what that number is.
Right.
But the number is 9 to me and 6 to you.
Yeah, right.
Like, we have two observations, like, or like a shape that makes a shadow or something like that.
Right.
Like, we can't, it's two things, but one. And like, I think that's where the problem lies, is like, we see this third party as strawman and things to argue against, and we grab onto that confirmation bias of like, oh, see, the Daily Show is really telling it like it is. That's how I think it is. And like, the Wall Street Journal hit it right on the head.
Slippery slope. And if you do that to the slippery slope.
That's slippery slope is itself its own crazy, stupid bias that tells you that the person doesn't know what they're talking about. Pro tip. Someone uses a slippery slope argument, they don't know what they're talking about. Anyway, so I always think those are so interesting, because when I read about them, I always think, not only, oh, wow, I'm completely predictable. I am everything. Nothing about me is original, and nothing about me, which can be both, I think, eye-opening and scary, but I think ultimately liberating, because in order to grow yourself and grow your ideas and grow your thought, you have to be able to see what else is out there and compare those things, and not just be fed all of the little cozy things that you're used to hearing. So cognitive biases, do be aware of them.
Yeah. So is there anything we can do?
Is there,
like, is it just
no.
to be aware, and
well,
try and like,
it is, I think I, cause I mean, it's the same thing with anything like race relations, like until, like, this year has been, I think, hard for everyone. And unless I think anyone who is legitimately interested in figuring out race relations has to figure out, like, where is that in me? Like, I'm realizing, like, oh, crap. Like, when a black guy comes up next to me at the store, I act super extra nice to him so he knows I'm not racist. Well, I'm treating him completely differently than I would anyone else, so that he knows how not racist I am.
Right.
But then, like, I'm also locking the door when some people walk up, you know? So I think you have to start, well, crap, you know, why did I, it's just behavior self-examination. Like, why did I react that way?
Yeah, it's behavior self-examination, and which is absolutely critical first step. And I think we see so much bias breakdown with any kind of relationship. Once it's not those gays, it's...
Yeah.
Mark and Nick, and I know them, and I'm friends with them.
Those people, those kind of people.
Right.
I think it is that personal relationship, because that's another thing. I'm like, wow, I don't really have any black friends. I mean, I know some black acquaintances that we get, but I mean, I don't have. And then I start, well, great. Well, then who am I listening to about what my ideas are and who should? And so it is just all of that painful self-examination that you have to go into preparing, like, where am I? I think where am I wrong is the place that you grow, not necessarily grow from, but if you go into it looking at, look, I need to figure out these things that are built into me so that I can learn how to get rid of them. So maybe it's the things that scare me the most, that it's just, that painful self-awareness, I think. And it's hard and it's painful, but I think ultimately it's the only way that I think you can get past some of that stuff is to know what to look for. I mean, it's just like marketing. Like, you see the word free. Now we all know that no longer means free ever because it always comes with the ad. It's just training yourself to see things like that, I think. But be armed with that information and then head straight to the Catholic Church app to ask forgiveness about it.
Well, Tyler and Charlie have hung out with us for almost the entire time.
Do Tyler and Charlie have any ideas for something we can play us out with at the end of the show?
Not the Small Wonder theme.
Of course it's a Small Wonder.
Small Wonder theme.
Although I feel like I played that already many times.
We did play that once, but it's been more than a year. Tyler and I have been chatting here
about Small Wonder.
Mostly about Small Wonder and a little bit about... Tyler, as a response to what I said about the increase in technology, he said, the decrease in chip size is a great example of why it might be hard for computers to continue to improve at the same rate that they have. Quantum tunneling may prevent transistors from even getting smaller. And so we chatted more about that. And I think that by reaching those limits, it triggers more creativity about expanding and going beyond those limits and divisively going around them and creating multi-layer chips.
Display technology is going to change a huge amount too, there's not going to be displays.
NVIDIA's stock has skyrocketed because they are the device manufacturer for screens for smaller devices. And every car that will be manufactured will have a screen in it, and they are the video card of choice, the video driver for all of those screens. And
what could go wrong? We'll have to do something while the robot's driving the car. So anyway,
And Chad Graham just joined.
Hello, Chad, goodbye because we're done with the show. That's a shame.
Sorry, Chad. You'll have to join us next time. And we have talked about having Chad on the show
to talk the science of beer and fermentation
and brewing
and all of that. Yeah, that'll be super interesting. Look for that in the new year.
Indeed.
indeed. And suddenly we both stopped talking. So thank you for joining us again on another episode of the Mark and Toddcast. You can find us at themarkandtoddcast.com, where all of our shows are posted. You can see us on Facebook at Mark and Toddcast. You can visit Portland at the movies soon on the internet.
Soon on the internet.
But right now on Facebook the episode 2 of that should be posted sometime this week about The Hunted. So it's your last chance to watch The Hunted before you listen to the episode if you have not.
Yeah, and Portland in the movies is... Brian the Unipiper and Todd and myself talking about movies that were filmed in and around Portland, Portland, Oregon.
Right.
And we try and pick from the bottom of the heap first. And we have been successful at that.
We had discovered there's no top of the heap when it comes to movies that have been made in Portland because they're all pretty awful.
And
But thanks for everyone who listened. If you have questions or comments, you can get us on the Facebook or send us an email, won't you? And I'm going to play us out with the Small Wonder theme song and listen out for my favorite lyric. She's fantastic, made of plastic.
She's a small wonder, lovely and bright and soft curls. She's a small wonder, a child.
I wonder if the show's on Hulu right now.
She's a miracle.
For sure. Not on Hulu.
She'll enchant you at her sight. She's a small wonder, and she'll make your heart take flight. La 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 la.
Only halfway through.
She's fantastic, made of plastic. Microchips here and there. She's a small wonder. Brings love and laughter everywhere.
Wow, what a different time that was. All right, see you guys next time.
Bye.